Just an observation more than a question. I know Adam used to quote an old song, "I fought the law and the law won." It seems to me that the problem with Extinction Rebellion and Just Oil is that the law simply changes to take into account the effectiveness of their protests. We see the public order laws being changed last year, a year before, making all this gluing to doors and blocking entrances ineffective, making them crimes. We've now got a new addition to the public order, where you don't even need to commit the crime to be arrested. But this has always been the case with capitalism, hasn't it? Whenever it's a resistance, the law changes to minimize the effect of workers' resistance. We saw it with the miners, where just traveling down the motorway was enough to make them get arrested. We saw it with Kettling, with the demonstrations, where people are held for hours without any charges. We see it now with the anti-strike law that's getting passed. So basically, Extinction Re XR is simply don't realise the power of the state. That's basically what I'm saying. And that's basically the observation I just want to make is that they underestimate the power of government.
Sorry, I think I muted myself then. Do you want to come back on that, Adam?
Yeah,
Adam, did you want to come back?
sure.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
I forgot to unmute myself.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just going to find the points that Hallam made about what should be done. They think that the government is well, I think Alan is right. They do underestimate the power of the state, and they think it's weaker than it is. And if they can imagine that, 3.5% of the population can overthrow a government. But interestingly, or inconsistently perhaps, in those points, strategical points, there were six or seven of them that Hallam made about how to overthrow the government. He does make one important one, which I think is right. They focus on the government, not intermediate targets. Government is the institution that makes the rules of society and has the monopoly of coercion to enforce them. So they're saying, look, if you're going to do direct action, bring it to bear on the government, not on well, I presume he's talking about not on individual corporations and so on, because at least that is a recognition that the government has a monopoly of the means of coercion. But Alan, you said that this is an attack on workers' resistance, but I don't think that you can say that. XR and Just Stop Oil are examples of workers' resistance. But what they do is, as you say, the government brings in legislation to, do them down. But that legislation is then used against genuine workers' resistance. And I don't think stopping people going to work, jumping on top of trains and all these other things which they did, to stop workers going about their ordinary business. I think it's anti-working class myself. I mean, I was a victim of it on two occasions myself in a car. I wouldn't have argued the case for socialism if I had a chance of meeting them.
Sorry, I forgot to unmute then. If Alan doesn't want to come back, I'll invite Comrade John Cumming to speak. And then I'll take
Yes.
Andrew. And then I'll take Andrew Davis.
That,
Sorry, go ahead,
yes, I
John.
think, yeah, I think it's quite fanciful the notion that the XR people have that with 3.5% of the population. Now, I know determined minorities can achieve quite a lot actually sometimes, but this presupposes something about the other 96.5% of the population. And it also presupposes that the government's going to lose its nerve. And that just won't happen. Certainly no British government. These bastards have been at this a long time. And they know how to manipulate people and use, wield the power that they have. So unlike other regimes, they won't suddenly turn and flee. But we saw other regimes which did lose their nerve in the Arab Spring, and some later recovered their nerve and came back with a vengeance. But this was with much larger percentages of the population, which you could then understand that the government could lose its nerve, especially if they know all the horrific things they've done to the people over the years. I would hope to see that horrible Iranian regime overthrown, but it looks as though they, a bit like the Syrian regime, are not going to quickly lose their nerve. So I think a lot of the talk from Extinction Rebellion is just that fanciful talk. And I think with 3.5% of the population, there's no way they're going to overthrow the government. That's just out of the question. And we've even seen much more than, well, I don't know if it's much more, but the people who organised the Not In My Name during the wars in the Gulf and in Iraq, a lot of people went to that were hitherto quite conservative. And these people, a bit like the people who went in demonstrations over the poll tax, you know, there was a massive amount of people hit the streets. And what did the government do? It didn't say, oh, maybe we better think twice about this war. No, they just carried on, determined in the knowledge that there were a lot of people took to the streets. But what were these people going to do? Supposing they did try to overthrow the government, what plan did they have? They were just reacting to, albeit a horrible thing that was being done. They took it to be in their name, but was actually being done in the name of Great Britain Limited, which is, as we all know, is actually the capitalist class. So, it's just a shame that people who would like to tackle what is actually a major problem, the whole climate change business, as we know, are just going down this mad route.
Okay, thanks, John. I'll take Andrew next. Okay, unless you want to respond to John at all.
No, I agree with 100% what he said.
I'll take Andrew next then. Thank you. Comrade Davis.
Yeah, thank you, Adam. That was a lovely talk. And also, I agree with everything John has just said. He's taken 50% of what I was going to say and already laid it out very eloquently. So thanks, John. Yes, I mean, the point is really 3.5%. It's a baloney, really, you know, to try to assume that that could ever have any purchase in any sort of capitalist form of democracy, or even state capitalist form of democracy. And it's very patronizing to the vast majority of people who have to try to scrape a living within the system. And Adam, you were affected by these silly protests that these people engage with, and so on. And I haven't been affected by it, but I know I'd be really livid if I was. So I find that really something that, you know, is just laughable, really, this idea that they're going to somehow change the nature of the state. And I think also, coming back as well to the talk, where Adam very sensibly and in a very balanced way talked about the way that the climate change problem is actually, to small extents, but realistic extents, actually being addressed by the capitalist class. And is being mitigated, and it will be mitigated. I'm no expert on the science, but I've always had a confidence that ultimately humanity can solve its own problems anyway, and technology and other ways that can be found will do that. So sort of on the other side of that coin, I think the vast majority of ordinary people, people I meet at work and, in daily life, would tend to hold to that view. They don't panic about the climate change. The BBC, Radio 4 might do, other areas of liberal media and so on probably do more than is good for any of us. This Extinction Rebellion, it sort of reminds me a bit, and other people around the meeting might have more knowledge of this, but I actually went with the old Birmingham branch to an event it was in Birmingham. I think it was one of the main I think it might have been the Labour Party conference or something. And there was this is back now about 10 or maybe even getting on for 15 years ago. There was this group then called the Occupy Movement, who this Extinction Rebellion crowd sort of remind me of a little bit, really. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but it's this sort of student radical politics, generally speaking, which hasn't got a democratic mandate in any way. It's just people trying to get, naturally worried about problems that are within the world. And they want to feel that they're doing something. I think the Extinction Rebellion group are probably a little bit more insidious than that, in that they do seem to have knowledgeable figureheads who may have agendas that they're not really openly speaking out. And the other one that it reminds me of as well in relatively recent times, probably within the last 10 or 15 years, is this thing that came out by Make Poverty History. Everybody was wearing sort of these sort of little bangles and armbands or something to, announce how opposed to world poverty that they were. It didn't achieve anything at all, of course. So it sort of has a kind of a, and I think Adam will relate to this. It has a sort of a touch of the Wolfie Smiths about it, really. I'm just not all that concerned about it, really. I'm more concerned about the way it affects ordinary people, working class people going out and trying to make their living, or maybe getting to, important appointments, maybe health appointments and things like that. And it just shows how arrogant people like this can be.
OK, thanks, comrade. Do you want to come back on that, Adam?
Yeah, I think we can draw a distinction between the leaders and the ideologues behind Extinction Rebellion and their followers, who might not necessarily share the strategic and tactical things of people like Hallam and the other mysterious people behind XR. I mean, I first came into politics myself in the 1960s through the CND, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. So when the people there were genuinely protesting against what they saw as a threat, but what we had to do as socialists, and what socialists did, as far as to me was to say, look, this is connected with capitalism, war and weapons are built into capitalism. So what we have to try and do with the followers of XR, if you like, is to get them to realize that it is linked up with capitalism, and the implications of what is required to get rid of capitalism. I mean, the only justification that you could possibly have, I think, for for demonstrations like this would be to raise consciousness that global warming is a problem. But I don't think that's necessary anymore. Most people already accept that there is a problem and something has been done about it. So I mean that stage has been reached. All they're doing now is based on wrong theories, both about the climate change and about political action. But, they're just confusing the issue.
Okay, thanks, Adam. I think it might be useful at a later stage in this meeting to have some sort of restatement about why we oppose to this idea of trying to make any sort of this green reformism. Why are we opposed to that? What is the mechanism of capitalism that makes it into this system that has given us this in existential problem? But I'll save that for later. For the minute, we'll take Comrade Thompson. Joel.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, hello? I can hear you at the back.
You can hear me? Adam?
Yes.
Yes, I can hear you. We can all hear you.
Right. I don't know if you heard that I read a piece last week about Extinction Rebellion attacking Greenpeace's HQ. Their founder hurled pink paint at Greenpeace headquarters to urge it to do more to fight climate change. Roger Hallam is also accused of attacking Friends of the Earth, Amnesty International and Christian Aid in 2020, along with other members of political group Burning Pink, which wants citizens' assemblies to replace government. Have you heard about that?
No, but it doesn't surprise me, because in his thing he wrote in 2019, he's quite harsh in his criticism of what he calls the reformist climate people, like Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth. He wants something more more radical than that. So it doesn't surprise me that he does that. Incidentally, you mentioned Burning Pink, or whatever it was called. In the European elections, they put up a candidate. The last ones, they had a candidate in London. We had candidates in the southeast region. And Hallam was a candidate himself. He got the same number of votes as we would got. 0.1% of the votes. I mean, that would be a sort of measure of the support that they get. I think they're a bit like the same mindset as the Trotskyists, isn't it? That you lead people into a battle, and you hope that's going to make them more radical. But I mean, even the Trotskyists are not so self-deluded as to think that they could overthrow capitalism, with 3.5% of the population. Hallam is quite a clever political operator, manipulator, in my opinion.
What's his background before all this?
I think he was involved in. I mean, I think he must have been involved, in the anti-poll tax thing, rent, community direct action. That's where it's coming from. But I mean, he obviously knows about capitalism because he uses the word himself. So I don't think he was a Trotskyist, but he was some sort of community activist. That sort of thing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, I think it's Paddy next.
Just a couple of things to pick up on what you were saying, Adam.
Is it Paddy? You've got your hand up.
It is me. Sorry, I was muted in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Schoolboy error. There you go. I'll say that again in that case. Just to pick up a couple of things that Adam mentioned, it occurred to me, well, one thing that occurred to me was, you know, this idea of 3.5% of the population, you know, can overturn the government. All right, okay, you know, you discussed that. And, it crossed my mind that if 3.5% of the UK population belonged to the Socialist Party, we'd have 2 million members, upwards of. And I think we'd be probably justified in feeling that the writing was on the wall for capitalism at that point. So it wouldn't happen in 2 weeks. But I think we could say we were definitely well on our way at that point. So 3.5% doesn't sound much, but it's not a million miles away from a sort of... I think we talked last year something about... there's a sort of tipping point in the population that you get to at around about, I can't remember what it was exactly, but it was about 25%. If you can tip 25% of the population to an idea, the rest will follow, you know. So, and I think it's something that is, it's actually useful for Hallam to kind of remind us that you don't actually need everybody all at once. There is a sort of, you know, there is this sort of concept of tipping point. Exactly where where you put it is debatable, but it's always going to be a fairly small minority that, you know, that's where all the hard work happens. And after that, you know, the thing then proceeds by its own momentum. And I think that's really useful for us to keep in mind, because where we are at the moment, it seems like an impossible mountain to climb. But, you know, that may very well change in the future with a bit of luck. Anyway, well, that was just one observation. The other thing was, you mentioned this bloke that lives down the road from me, Jem Bendel. I came across him back when he produced a paper called Deep Adaptation. I meant to go and interview him, but I think I must have been too lazy or something, so I didn't get around to it. But he's only just down the road at University of Cumbria. And it was kind of interesting because Deep Adaptation was this paper that had such a stark prognosis on the future. This is a guy who said, if you haven't got a greenhouse now, get one, because in 10 years' time, there's going to be no food in the supermarkets. This was how bad he was painting it. It was practically a sort of zombie apocalypse he was kind of painting. And reputedly, students that read his paper sought psychiatric help after reading it. Now, you'd think that in that case, Jem Bendel must be at least a climate scientist, but in fact he's not at all. And his paper was refused by most of the august journals because he didn't have the qualifications. In fact, what he is a professor of is something called sustainability leadership, and he was awarded the title of I think it was young leadership. Hero of the year or something by World Economic Forum at Davos, you know, so he's that's his kind of credentials. I was thinking in connection with this, this was something I read, and it was so shocking that I almost laughed, you know, because it was so over the top. And I thought, you know, there's no sense of a balance here. And we've heard a lot in the last decade about climate denialism, you know, climate deniers. And this is sort of the opposite of that, isn't it? I don't even know what the opposite of a climate denier is. Adam and I were talking about it, and I thought of the word catastrophizer. This is a term I came across quite recently. Apparently, this is a thing that allegedly, you know, adolescents do. You know, every little upset is instantly a huge catastrophe. That doesn't really describe any adolescence I've ever known, but you know, this is what they supposedly do. And I thought, well, you know, Jem Bendel is a climate catastrophizer, and why do you need catastrophizers to make the thing sound worse than it is? And I suppose it must be because if you instill this sort of sense of deep panic, it must be really good for recruitment in the short term, because, you know, people, you know, you're appealing to a sort of desperation motivation. And when I've been to XR meetings, where incidentally there's no debate allowed, you're not even allowed to ask questions. You get told what's what, and then you get told to sign up to chain yourself to a tractor or something. You know, they're not interested in any kind of normal discursive processes of a public meeting. I suspect that people may be in the short term motivated by this sort of induced desperation, but it's not going to last. It's going to dissipate as people either get fed up with getting arrested all the time, or they begin to suspect more likely that they've been strung along, you know, to serve the agendas, the personal agendas of people like Roger Hallam. So, but having said that, I also feel inclined to sort of slightly play devil's advocate and say that I do feel quite sympathetic, actually, in some ways, with Extinction Rebellion, because what they've done it's not just that they've highlighted, global warming, climate change, species extinction, all these sort of things. As Adam says, these were all well known before. I think what they've done is they've lit a fire under it. I get the impression sometimes in discussions that we have in the Socialist Party is that we almost expect everyone to be well behaved and abide by the law. And I don't think the revolution is going to be well behaved. And in fact, I don't want people to be well behaved. I want them to be more bolshy, even if it pisses people off in the process. And what I particularly like about Extinction Rebellion isn't that they just highlighted something that was already highlighted. What they've done, I think, which is crucial, is they've forced people to make the key connection between climate change and capitalism as a system, and it's forced them to ask existential questions about capitalism, and that's new. That wasn't being done before, and I think good for them for doing that. Not just them. I mean, there are other people who are doing that too. I mean, Greta Thunberg is doing that too at the moment. George Monbiot has been doing it. All of that is really good for us, because instead of socialism being a nice idea in theory, what they are doing is, whether they mean to or not, they are converging on our position with a much greater sense of existential urgency, which we've always said that socialism is urgent, but we don't sound like we mean it, but they sound like they mean it, and they will make, I think, workers in general really sit up and start to think, can we do without capitalism? Can we abolish capitalism? Can we afford not to abolish capitalism? So I think this is generally good for us. So anyway, that's all I'm going to ramble about. Thanks.
Okay, I'm sure Adam wants to come back to that. If he doesn't, I'll be surprised.
Well, not necessarily, but I think we are in a bit of a dilemma, because people are saying that, you know, there's a worst case scenario. It's going to be 5%. And we're saying, no, it isn't. It's not going to be as bad as that. It's only going to be 3%. It makes us, I mean, saying capitalism isn't as bad as other people are making out. We get criticised for being soft on capitalism. So the same thing's happened when we say bankers aren't the real enemy. It's a whole capitalist system or the whole capitalist class. We get accused of being soft on bankers and so on. So it's a bit of a dilemma. But I suppose in the end, as Paddy was saying, it's best to be accurate and honest about this. I mean, this 5% scenario, it really would be, hell. 3% is going to be bad enough. I'm sure that'll lead to population movements, and so on, which incidentally seems to be the, likely outcome.
Can I just interrupt a second?
We can't predict what will happen between now and the end of the century. It's on course at the moment for about 3%, which is 2% more than.
Can I just interrupt there, Adam? You keep saying 3%, 5%. It's not 3% and 5%. It's 3 degrees and 5 degrees. It's quite a big difference.
Yes, sorry, you're right. When I'm editing my own articles, I always have to change it back from percent to degrees. So it's not going to rise by another. Well, it's already risen now, you know, 1 degree since pre-industrial times. In the worst case scenario, which was drawn up, it was going to raise a further 4%. Sorry, further 4 degrees.
4 degrees.
Further four. Degrees to 5 degrees. So that is not going to happen. It doesn't look as on course for that. So we're saying to some of these people, look, you're saying it's going to be 5 degrees. We're saying or the evidence is that it's probably not going to be that. And as I say, we appear to be less critical of capitalism than them. But I think, as I was going to say, that we've got nothing. Well, we should be honest about this. Otherwise, people will turn around and say you misled us. You know.
Okay, Comrade McClellan, Doogie, off you go.
It's interesting. They can't convince everybody. They can only convince a few people, and the people who are willing to glue themselves to various machinery or whatever, you know, they can change society, right? You know, and some anarchists think the same thing, right? You know, they don't think, you know, you've got to convince a lot of people. I suppose if we had a few million members, you know, we'd be pretty close to socialism. So they think if they get a few million members, they can do something about, you know, climate change or whatever. But I don't know. I mean, I've heard anarchists argue that our idea about putting people into parliament or whatever, you know, they don't trust it, right? You know. And I think it's born out of the idea that, you know, people aren't going to change that much, and a minority has to lead the way, right? You know, a bit like the Trots or whatever. So I don't know how they get around that, right? You know, and they exaggerate everything. Me and Paddy went to meetings of Extinction Rebellion, and they weren't open to dialogue. They just wanted to instill activity into people to go and break the law, basically, you know. And as you say, it upsets a lot of workers when they block roads and things like that, right, you know. So I don't know. But they seem similar to some anarchists, right, you know, thinking that a minority can change things.
Okay, Doogie. Thank you. I don't think... Do you want to come back, Adam? If not, I'll go straight to Comrade Deutz. Oh, okay. Sorry. Go ahead, Adam. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I think it is a legitimate point to say that if you've got 3.5% committed, there'll be another 15 or 20% who are sympathetic. But I don't think that XR is in that position. If they really think in April that they'll get 100,000, I think that'll be a big ask. But they would then have to have another 3 or 4 times, you know, or 20 more times than that in the country who was sympathetic towards. I don't think, you know, if you haven't got that, which you're really, you know, it's what used to be called adventurism. You know, they'll be out on their own. You know, but I think it is a valid argument that there will be some people who are committed, and other people who are sympathetic, and other people who will go along. But there has to be at least a majority of people sympathetic to what's, you know, trying to be achieved, and I imagine that will be the case with socialists, like you know, Paddy says, to some extent.
Okay, before I bring Pat in, I just want to stick my oar in for a minute, which is I looked at a video that one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion brought out. I can't remember her name, but she's basically saying, We're not bothered about we're not trying to change capitalism. What we want to do is we want to stop burning of the fossil fuels. apart from that, we're not interested in anything. That's I mean, obviously, that's very basic. So to my way of thinking, the roots of this, and which I'm talking about 2 years ago that I think some that I was watching this video, they're not anti-capitalist at all. And I don't... I was a bit surprised with what Paddy said, that he thinks that he's drawing people's attention to the nature of capitalism. I don't think they're doing anything of the sort, personally. But anyway, OK... Sorry, I've just abused chair's privilege. I'll go to Comrade Deutsch.
Yes, Andrew, go back to you referred to someone saying about, and I can't remember the person's name, it doesn't matter, the predictions of disaster, you know, of how bad things are. So I have to say I'm less... optimistic than what's been stated here of the capitalist governments being able to do some meaningful mitigation. They are prepared to actually, you know, to kill people. So, you know, how they're doing. But these predictions of disaster took me back to CND Times, and some may remember that a woman had written to Khrushchev and other leaders, talking about how many nappies she'd washed and so on. And I was shopping in Ilford, and there she was speaking on a platform with a CND meeting there. And what she was saying was, well, I don't expect to be still alive by Christmas. In other words, you know, expecting that the nuclear war would be breaking out that year. And I spoke to people who were at the meeting and said about, you know, opposition to war. And I was introduced to a pacifist and then obviously went a bit further. But no one was interested. They were, it was a sort of this one first, this urgent thing that's got to be dealt with before we can think about anything different. And it would be nice to think that that things had gone further than that, that people were, enough people, in fact, were prepared to think that this one first has to be dealing with the basis of the problem, which is capitalism itself, and how to deal with that. But I mean, the party did it a bit with a pamphlet on "Is a Third World War Inevitable?" And I don't think that you can actually frighten people into taking action. Some people, of course, you can, but for others, it's a turning away, and their everyday problems take precedence over something that may be going to be happening, you know, in X number of years. I mean, things are bad enough as they are with what is happening with the climate change and the fires and everything going on. But well, before I start rambling, that's about it, Comrade. Thank you.
Thanks, Comrade. I've got John coming again. Are you off you go, John?
Yes, just briefly to return to the question of the 3.5 million. Someone mentioned if we had a million, we would begin to think we were getting somewhere. And I think we certainly would. The difference between a million of us and a million of them, unfortunately, is that if you're a million or more of people, as we saw in various wars and protests about them, and you're just opposed to this or that aspect of capitalism, then you don't have the same implacable hostility that socialists would have towards any of the state's attempts to convince you back, as they would see it, to the path of righteousness and supporting capitalism. Nothing they would say could work on us. Whereas a lot of the people who just object to horrible things about society, unfortunately, they can be placated, but we can never be placated. So a million of us really would be qualitatively different. And if I could see that, I'd hoped that I would see it, but I'm now kind of despair that I will ever see that. But if I could see even a few hundred thousand, I would begin to become much more optimistic. It's not to say I think I would expect to live to see it, but I would expect that the ball is beginning to roll on the whole question of revolution.
Okay, thanks very much. Go to Comrade Davis now, please. Don't forget to unmute Andrew, please.
I'm really enjoying this discussion. There's a great range of views being expressed, which is always very good, in a very harmonious way. One of the things that I just thought about, just sort of pondered on as we were moving through the discourse, was that climate change and you know, I spent a bit of time, actually. I took a career break in the last year or so, and I've gone back to my other career now. So I'm back to being a humble care home manager. But I spent a year working as a teaching assistant at a specialist school for young people with moderate learning disabilities. And it was really interesting. I loved it. I really enjoyed the work. But one of the things about it that was very interesting to me was how different the curriculum is now since I was at school. One of the things that kids get taught now is about a thing called sustainability. I don't need to tell you what they mean by that. But it's part of the core curriculum now. And sort of like they sort of inculcate kids now into this idea that capitalism needs to go green, which again ties into, you know, the agendas about. I think, is it at the moment, what are we told, that we all have to have electric cars by 2030? Is that right? You're lucky if you can afford a car in the first place, let alone an electric one. This idea about this sort of radical green economy now that's going to create all this wealth seems to be the new holy grail. And obviously it's all part of the sort of new ways to create profit margins. I think I know where Adam is coming from on some of his points, although we'd have to talk in private about it. Adam, you know, you're a Welshman, and my grandfather was a Welshman, and he worked down the pit in Pontypridd, right? And he always said there was nothing wrong with coal. It was just being a miner that was the thing that was bad, really. He also told me that going to war in the Second World War was the best thing that ever happened to him, because it got him out of the pit. But I think there's a whole issue here about, you know, are we against, you know, sort of natural products that we can use in a creative way, you know, such as coal and oil and things like that? Or are we against? Them? You know, now it seems that the Extinction Rebellion people and the Just Stop Oil people, I'm sorry if I conflate the two, because there probably is a difference between their sort of hierarchies and groups and whatever. But there probably are different groups, but it seems to me there must be some sort of a link, and the general agenda towards sort of this greening of capitalism. It's all linked up, isn't it? And I don't think we should be too focused on riding that chariot, really, to be honest. I think we should stand for, you know, essentially saying, well, you know, it's the usage of these resources within capitalism that causes the problem. That's a bit of a ramble, but I hope it provokes some response. Thank you.
Well, I think we've got your main point, Andy. I think that's okay. Do you want to come back on, Adam?
Yeah. I mean, the thing with coal and especially oil is that there are other uses to put them to. Rather than burning them, I think that the problem is that you know, coal and oil are mainly used now to, as I say, to, you know, to be burned, and therefore you know releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. I mean, there are other uses of them, even under capitalism. So I don't think we could necessarily say that in a socialist society, there wouldn't be any oil taken from the ground. But so I mean, there's a valid point there that you make. That's what I would say on that. You know, but even in socialism, we'll have to use resources in a I don't know, ecologically responsible, you know, responsible way. And I'm sure you know, burning coal and oil on a massive scale, you know, won't happen. But on the other hand, you're still going to need another bugbear of activists. You're probably still going to need nuclear power in a socialist system of society, because of the, you know, the renewable energy, or you know, wind power and sun, solar energy, and so on. You know, they depend on the wind blowing and the sun shining. If it doesn't, you're going to need something which can produce, you know, the basic basic power. And the obvious one is nuclear power. But I don't think we need to get into we can talk about this as a speculation of what socialist society might do. But we needn't actually take a position saying, you know, we are in favour of nuclear power. But I suppose our position will be we're not necessarily against nuclear power.
Andrew, do you want to come back in? If you're doing it, yeah, okay.
Yeah, just to say I agree with what Adam has just said. You know, we shouldn't be against these natural resources being used in whatever way we can apply our energies to them.
Okay, thank you. Comrade, come in again then, please.
Yes, I just wanted to perhaps remind people that although a lot of this talk about climate change and whatnot appears to be perhaps the latest thing to a lot of people, we in the Socialist Party have always, ever since I can remember, when I first met the party back in the early 70s, have always been hostile to the destruction of the ecosystem. And I mean, I've known about these problems for over 50 years myself, and that was one of the main reasons I wanted to join the Socialist Party, because first of all, what capitalism does to people and what it does to their environment is so awful. But I thought only socialism can really remedy that. There's no other framework in which we can abolish all the damage to the ecosystem and also abolish the horrible social system that condemns people to live in poverty, ridiculous poverty, because there's absolutely no need for it anymore. So it's just a thing that's probably worth bearing in mind, that we were probably pioneers to some extent about talking about ecological matters, and other people that we think probably don't have a very good grasp of the science behind it, are kind of making other more extravagant claims. And we are probably, or we try anyway, to make more measured claims about things to try and understand what the science is actually saying, and to recognise, you know, to what extent capitalism might be able to address the problem. I'm not very optimistic about that. It will try, but even if we get socialism tomorrow, it's going to be a hard job to try to start setting the environment back to where it should be. I mean, there's species dying out all over the place, and that's really mainly to do with capitalism's encroachment on the habitats of other creatures on this planet. So, you know, I don't think there's any danger of us concentrating too much on these issues. The danger would be to put forward a maybe not very well understood critique of what's happening. But I think the critique that we have put forward about these matters, such as pollution of the environment and the climate change and whatnot, I think has been quite a reasonable and well-informed, you know, as far as we can be, position.
Thanks, John.
Come on, Steve.
Hello.
Howard here. Sorry, I'm not on my own machine and I can't...
Go on, go ahead then. Go
can on. I say a word? Okay.
Please say a word. Hold on.
Okay. Can I sort of agree with Paddy on one thing that most of the people don't seem to agree on, and that is that I think climate, not just XR in particular, but climate change activists are actually doing us a favour in making the connection between climate change and capitalism. Okay, they don't necessarily mean exactly the same thing as we mean by capitalism, and they're not. They don't necessarily see it as being resolved by in the way that we see it as being resolved. But nevertheless, they are making people think very hard about the connection between climate change and the system we live under. No doubt about that. I mean, look at the books that are being written at the moment about it. There's a brilliant book which is reviewed in, I'm not sure if it's in this month's Standard, but in a recent Standard called Bright Green Lies, which is, you know, he doesn't exactly put our case, but it's relatively close in many ways. Anyone who reads it is going to think about the system we live under and whether it's possible to actually, without a radical change, without getting rid of it, whether it's whether it's possible to deal with the climate situation. So let's not be too damning of these people. I think their action is, well, there are negative sides to it, admittedly, as some people have said, but there are also positive sides, which I think we do need to appreciate and acknowledge.
Okay, thank you, Howard. Comrade Carter.
I have a very odd light system here. Would it be possible to...
Oh, Vin. Things? Okay, I'll take Comrade Carter first, Vin, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay, and then you next. All right. Janet, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I agree with some of the things that Howard just said. I agree with most things that most people have said, but just the last one is that there are no doubt strands within our society, which strands of people's thinking, which is going towards socialism as we define it, and it must be very difficult for them because they're actually going against all their own training and education and their family and groups, because there are so... It is so limited, this idea of a society of cooperation and not capitalism. So I think that the large numbers of people that we need to come to this idea may throughout the world already be there, but they're so isolated and unable to join together and know that there are others thinking the same way as they are, edging towards, but haven't yet fully understand what they're trying to understand. And as John said about coming to the party or the ideas of the party 50 odd years ago, one of the things that made me sort of urgently question what was going on in society was the Rachel Carson book, which was in I think the early 60s, and the spring, and I thought that was a very devastating example of what was happening without people taking it fully on board. And I always wondered about some of the people who are very active within the ecology movement can't themselves jump more quickly in their ideas from one quite circumscribed idea to a fuller view of society. And at present, people's families are being split by those who want to fly and those who don't. I have a niece who has a home in Spain and one in Britain and likes to fly backwards and forwards. And some of us are thinking, looking at her rather askance. This is not quite the right way to behave. But of course, she's one of the poorer members of the working class in comparison to the great wealth that some people have. And she's just enjoying the fruits of her and her husband's hard work throughout their life and the pensions that they now have. And who can blame her? The other thing I wanted to say was I think that John puts a great clarity of ideas that we hold into words, and it's really nice to hear him. And this discussion is really interesting. And there was something else I wanted to say, but I've forgotten. So I'll stop now for the time being.
Okay, thanks, Janet. Just before I go to Vin, Paddy, can you take over the chair, please? Because my battery's about to run out, so I need to plug myself in. All right, I'm just trying to hold off. Okay, all right, you okay with that? Thank you. Over to Vin, then.
Okay, well, let's just say something pretty basic about capitalism and climate change. Yeah? Climate change... The reason why there's a lot of energy used, because capitalism is all about making stuff. I live on a road where there's 400 houses and there's probably 400 lawnmowers. So many bloody, some of them really crap, some of them extremely good. Capitalism, it's all about owning shit. Under socialism, we're not going to, we're going to not have a lot of stuff. We're not going to have police. We're not going to have soldiers. There's going to be a lot of... Yeah, the need for energy is going to be completely different. I can't say how much it's going to be, but what I can say, and when Comrade Adam says, well, yes, we might need nuclear power, socialism is not going to be, it's not going to be a system where people are going to have to go into extremely dangerous jobs, and the production of nuclear power, at the rawest level, is extremely dangerous. And, we're not going to have fellow working class people doing dangerous jobs, which have hitherto existed because we needed all this amount of energy, because we've got to make all this sort of stuff in order to run capitalism. So maybe I'm just being a bit too basic or too naive here, but I think socialism's, it's pretty obvious. Socialism's not a society where it only works because you make loads of stuff. And in order to make loads of stuff, you'll have to have enormous amounts of energy that is causing an awful lot of damage to the planet. That's all I'm going to say. Thanks.
Thanks, Vin. Just before I go to Janet, it's interesting what you were just saying there, Vin. I'm just going to abuse the chair, well, for just a second. I've just been having a number of discussions with various people in the party just lately about that, this kind of unspoken assumption that socialism, will automatically require the same energy levels as capitalism. I mean, I agree with you. I think probably a lot of people here would as well, that is a completely ridiculous assumption. In fact, we've not really looked at how socialism might manage its energy and what sort of things we wouldn't do that capitalism typically does. Interesting subject. So anyway, I'll just... Janet's back again. Janet, did you want to speak, or did you just leave your hand up from last time?
I think I've remembered what I wanted to say before. Can you hear me now? I unmuted myself?
You have, yeah. Just carry on. Thanks. Yeah, carry on.
Thanks. I was going to go on to say about it's a massive production or the use of oil and coal that has caused the problem since industrialization. And if somebody had a little bit of coal at the bottom of their garden and just burnt that occasionally, it probably wouldn't do any harm. That's it's the factories and mills and mines that have caused this ecological catastrophe, really. But I was thinking, if humanity can lay transatlantic cables across to transmit telephone calls, why can't that be done with electricity from one part of the world that has a lot of sun to another part that doesn't have very much sun, so that they would be, if it could be stored, there could be the capacity to use the solar production spread throughout the world. And the same with water. If oil pipes and gas pipes can be laid for hundreds and hundreds of miles, why can't water pipes be laid from hundreds and hundreds of miles, so that one part that is flooding can transfer water to another part that actually needs water? It can be done, and humanity could do it if there is a mindset was such that it was thought on a global and a human scale to look after everybody, and just within the national boundaries of countries. I think that's all now. Thank you.
Thanks, Janet. I'm very pleased you said that, actually, Janet, because I said the same thing about water pipelines once, and everybody in the party laughed at me. So I'm glad you're backing me up.
Can I just say something?
Yeah, go on.
Well, speaking as an electrical engineer, there are sort of limits in the amount and the ways that electricity can be transmitted. But, I mean, really, the point I want to make is, you know, when we're talking about how power should be used, what happens in capitalism is we need nuclear power. So workers, it's tough, you're going to have to do it. Socialism, it's we need power, right, but it's too dangerous for workers to create work nuclear power, so we're going to have to do something else. You know, when things are done for the benefit of the workers, then perhaps, you know, the way we get energy changed, really. I think that was the point I was trying to make earlier, which I hope I've made now.
Right, okay, thanks for that, Vin. Okay, over to Andrew next.
I'm loving this, it's great. Okay, this is just a little gentle, kind, comradely pushback at Comrade Vin and a little bit at Comrade Shannon as well. I came into the Socialist Party by pure accident. I think it was about 25 years ago or something like that now. I met a member at the time who looked like Doctor Who. His name was Ron Cook. And he wrote a book called Yes, Utopia. We have the technology. So I always like to, you know, sort of push back on the idea that within socialism, indeed within capitalism, as we are at the moment, you know, this idea that we need less. Actually, we should have more. This idea that we go back to a more basic way of life, well, that's a choice perhaps that people could choose in some form of social organisation that's you know, beyond capitalism. But I think that plays into this idea of limits, and we're only limited by our, you know, by our imaginations and by our scope of our knowledge, really. Now, you may have come across people like I have done in the course of my lifetime where they would say, oh, you know what, I don't think I want to have kids. No way. I don't want to bring kids into this sort of a society, into this sort of a world. It's not a good thing. It's unethical. It's not right to have children and to bring them in. Or even if they do, they would say, oh, well, you know, we might just have one kid or two kids because that's all we can afford. Actually, I think there would be a population boom once socialism, you know, kind of is happening. So we would have to provide resources. And we can provide resources because the resources are there. It's how we interact and how we manage those resources and develop those resources. And I'm talking about material resources here, you know. So this idea that we've all got to sort of live, you know, in a kind of hair shirt society and socialism, frankly, really sort of, you know, it sort of depresses me a little bit. Thank you.
Okay, well, when I'm saying talking about, say, 400 lawnmowers, my thoughts, you know, looking at the party's line, we will be living in a society without property where everything is under common ownership. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have these things, that we should put on hair shirts and that we should all go and live in caves. What I'm saying is that capitalism cannot be run as efficiently as socialism. There's lots of waste in capitalism. For example, everyone has a washing machine. It's perfectly feasible for things to be run better, for us to be living better, maybe better technology lines, but, you know, with more abundance. But, you know, the first things we've got to do, of course, is to make sure that everyone has abundance and stuff like, you know, everyone having a car, a stuff. You know, I'm not saying we go back to the... I'm just saying that socialism, as far as I'm concerned, is arranging resources better so that everyone lives better lives, not everyone going back and living in grass huts.
Andrew, did you want to just come back in briefly?
Yeah, just a very simple point. Please don't take this the wrong way, Vin. I totally take your point. But obviously, we know capitalism is a world of, you know, massive abundance that is just rationed in a hugely wrong way. And, you know, we don't need to think about having shared washing machines and things like that. I've got to go to the launderette tomorrow, by the way. But, you know, we shouldn't be on that sort of page, really.
Well, the washing machines was an example. I mean, I'm just saying this is what happens when you have a society that is based on private ownership.
Right, I'm going to have to stop this because people are waiting to speak. But sorry. So you've had a bit of a bit of a go at this one. I was going to sort of chip in myself, but I'll let Vin speak. Vin spoke in my view anyway. So yeah, definitely an interesting discussion. You know, it can be maybe brought up on another occasion. Meanwhile, we've got Steve waiting in the queue. Steve, as was chair.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm just going to. I'm afraid I'm just going to carry on.
Okay.
A couple of minutes because. Because I completely disagree with what Andrew's been saying. All right, we're not a shirt socialist, definitely, absolutely not. But we've got to put, I think, in a socialist society, we'll break this idea between I need this ownership of things, except for I would suggest a very, very few personal possessions, because what we're not. What people won't be interested in the socialist societies is, once you've got, you've overcome the idea that there's scarcity and that there's rationing, then the very idea of I need my own bloody it's the drill, isn't it? It's just the usual thing. We'll break that connection, and what we'll have is people actually. Being a bit rational about things and saying, well, look, all that I really need is I need a bit of transport. I don't need a car. I need transport. I need transport when I need it. Therefore, I'm not going to have a car. I can't imagine that any socialist society would want to support a system whereby everybody's supposed to have a bloody whatever it is. However, whether it's electric or what, it would be an absolute nonsensical, irrational use of the world's resources. And to suggest that we go out, that we don't, we shouldn't have an. I think we do need an attitude towards this as a party, because we cannot go along with the idea that seems to have been put about in by Marx, by Engels, about the domination of nature and all this sort of thing. We're not going to do that. We're part of nature, and we've got to make sure we've got a finite set of resources. And I appreciate that in a capitalist society, there's absolute waste and all that. But I still think there's got to be some sort of rational way that we use the things, and that doesn't include, oh, I want my own iron, I want my own bloody washing machine, etc., etc. That I'm pretty sure that we'll move to a more communal form of living. But the real thing that I wanted to say, I'm sorry, I couldn't resist chucking in on that. But the real thing that I want to say is that we need to keep attacking these people. We need to keep attacking this Extinction Rebellion. For one thing, this anti-democratic approach that they're taking is always going to end up, there's no doubt about it, it's going to end up with us having more restrictions placed on our own political activity. It's really difficult these days. You've got this idea now that you can't have a noisy demonstration, and that's because of these big dickheads that go and try to harass people going to abortion clinics and things like that. All this, I can see this Extinction Rebellion with working class support end up with more repressive legislation that will affect us as socialists and us as trade unionists. The other criticism of them that I've got is that they've not got to understand the capitalism, and we've got to keep pushing this idea that capital is a perpetual expansion system, and that's where the problem comes from. All that you look at the, for example, the Green Party, which is, I presume has got a little bit more support at the elections than Roger Hallam. They're talking about some sort of small scale capitalism. Absolute bullshit, and they keep and these are supposedly serious politicians. Anyway, that's it. Started rambling. Thank you
very much. Right, okay, John's next.
Yes, just on the question of the waste of capitalism and having done away with that, the things that will then become possible in socialism. So I think that's what we have to think about. Some stuff, some products we'll have more of. Others, there won't be any need to keep senselessly manufacturing more and more cars, for example. When I used to have to actually physically drive to my workplace, every day I had to go through this insane journey and using up 100 square feet of road space just to transport one person in a queue to get to his work so that he can make the world nice for rich people. This seems an exercise in pointlessness to produce all these cars when what people really need, and even within capitalism, there are some people talking in these terms, although it becomes hideously complicated by, oh, well, you just put your credit card in here and you'll, you know, because you have to obviously pay for everything in capitalism. But what you need is access to a vehicle. So everyone doesn't need to have their own vehicle. And in some parts of the world, they have little systems where you can have, albeit small vehicles like bicycles. But in this country, because of partly for ideological reasons, it seems to smack too much of them of socialism. If you shared a bike or you, God forbid, shared your car, and not your car, but you didn't feel the need to actually own it. And that's what socialism would make possible, is that you wouldn't need to clutter up the road with all these vehicles. quite possible to work out an optimum level of vehicles that would be needed for the journeys that people need to make, and make these available. And then you would have people whose task it might be for part of the day to work out how to make sure there's enough vehicles at various appropriate collection points and drop-off points. It's not beyond the capabilities of human beings to work these things out. And in that way, we can actually have a better quality of life, more of some stuff that we need to have. But of course, we don't need to have this obsessive notion that you have to own one of everything. Like the lawnmower, that's a really good example. I look out the back and see all these people cutting their back gardens or using it for their front lawns and things like that. And they all have a machine each. Now, it would be better, rather than produce all these unnecessary machines, if you could, again, in that situation, say, what's the optimum number of machines we need to do this? Or do we really need to have these absurd little lawns, which are not necessarily all that ecologically sound? So we might live in bigger units, bigger family units, bigger communities in some senses, so we don't necessarily all live in our own little house, but perhaps live in slightly larger accommodation. There's all sorts of different possibilities that socialism opens up. But one thing it's not compatible with is this notion that's put about in capitalism, oh yes, we'll have to do our bit for the climate change. Well, of course we do, but what these people who are part of officialdom and part of the capitalist media, what they're doing is they're trying to spread the blame. And as far as we're concerned, most members of the working class have very little agency to have any real effect. It's something in which the whole of society needs to join in if we're going to make a difference to the environment in which we live. And that's only possible by removing this awful system and replacing it with socialism. So that's all I have to say about that. Oh, yes, and the electrical transmission, the technical problem. Well, current does dissipate over long distances. That's why you have big pylons to transport electricity over large distances. But, you know, that's not going to be a problem. There's other ways around that, and there's vast means of untapped resources to produce electricity locally. That would then become available in socialism. So the big problem is getting over the obstacles in the road of people's ability to understand socialism and do something about organising for socialism. That's the big problem. You know, once we've got not even a million, a few hundred thousand, we'll be, well, at least we'll be much happier than we are now.
Okay, thanks, John. Moggy next.
Right, hello. Yes, well, I just want to stick my oar in. Now, this thing about everyone having cars and driving miles and miles to go to work, well, of course, it's not necessary. I think under socialism, people will work closer to home. This thing about, you know, having to drive miles and miles down motorways to get to work and then drive miles and miles to get back home. And there seems to be this obsession with wanting to get there faster and faster and faster. Well, how about slowing things down? I think if we got rid of cars and everyone went back to using donkeys and carts, you'd have time to smell the roses. I think you've got to get rid of this obsession of getting faster and faster and faster, and maybe think about getting slower and slower, and maybe working closer to home instead of having to commute for miles every day. So that's, you know, that's what I think about that. Then this thing about lawnmowers. Well, I absolutely agree. Everybody doesn't need to have a lawnmower. I've not got a lawnmower. There's a chap that comes around once every 3 weeks with a weed eater, and he weed eats my lawn for me, which takes him 10 minutes. And then he goes on, does another house and another house and another house. And he comes back to me 3 weeks later and does the same thing again. Well, that works just fine. So if a lot more people use that sort of system, that would cut out the need for everyone having to have their own individual lawnmower. Then this thing about electricity, you can spread electricity over a long distance. In Wellington, where I live, we get our electricity actually from the South Island of New Zealand. And there is what we call the Cook Strait cable. And that's a big electric cable that sits along the seabed. And it comes up from the South Island to the North Island, and that's where we get our electricity from. So electricity can be conducted over quite a long distance, you don't have to have pylons at regular intervals at all. You can send it quite a long way. So those are just my thoughts on those few points. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Margaret. I'm glad you said that.
Paddy, can I say a quick word, Paddy?
Oh, go on then. Yeah.
Howard here. Just a quick word. Yeah. On the question of hair shirts. A good many years ago, the party produced a pamphlet called Socialism as a Practical Alternative. In that pamphlet was listed a whole load of activities which were very expensive of resources and time, which would not be needed within capitalism. We know all about them, sort of banking, insurance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We do say this, don't we, that capitalism is an incredibly wasteful system. It's in Ron Cook's book as well, by the way, Yes, Utopia. I recently saw a list of the weapons that are being sent to Ukraine by the various Western powers. It's just mind-boggling, the resources that go into producing those weapons. And on the other side, the Russians are producing similar weapons. This is the kind of waste we've got within capitalism. We wouldn't have that in a socialist society. We'd be producing for use, for need, not for waste. And therefore, the idea that we might need these sort of potentially dangerous procedures like producing coal, oil, nuclear power, doubt whether it would be on the agenda. I just don't think people would want to know about that kind of thing. There would be the resources, all the resources we needed to produce the things that we need. That's a point which I think sort of needs to be made here. Nobody's mentioned waste capitalism produces, and will carry on producing as long as it exists.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Howard. I'm going to step in at this point. I'm not abusing chair privileges. I did stick my hand up, and nobody else has got theirs up. So I'm just going to on what Moggy just said about the cable from South Island. I don't know if some of you saw the news story that Britain has now got an undersea electricity cable, a 1400 megawatt cable that connects UK to Norway. It's 450-mile long cable. That was just brought in 2021. So that was online then. So yeah, big cables. There's no technical issue with the feasibility. It's more to do with market feasibility. Is it viable under capitalist market conditions? Which of course, in socialism we wouldn't have to worry about. I can't resist mentioning, again, with the lawnmowers. Andrew, you've really started something here, haven't you? Again, with the lawnmowers. But it occurred to me, well, the thing is, lawnmowers do get used every summer, once a week every summer. Power tools, on the other hand, on average, only get used for the job that they were bought for. And then they sit on a shelf. And according to something I read years ago in New Scientist, the average working life, that's in use, the average working life of a power tool from shop shelf to landfill is about 20 minutes. Now, Andrew, if you think about the abundance of socialism in terms of you having all your own power tools, you can sort of start to see how illogical and absurd that notion of abundance is. Like, socialism isn't about having, you know, more than we've got in capitalism, but it's also not about making do with less. It's about getting more work out of less stuff, so that we have to produce less stuff, we make sure it works properly, and we share it properly. I think it was Bill Martin years ago who gave a talk about the idea of libraries. You know, you have book libraries and you have clothes libraries in. He's got his own power tool, Andrew, yeah. I hope you're sharing it around. Bill was saying, well, this is the sort of model of that you'd adopt for a lot of things in socialism. You just have, you know, local municipal libraries or village libraries or whatever. So, and just one other thing on this.
Yeah.
One other thing on this is, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, the greening of the world economy, green capitalism, green tech. This is going to cause a whole bunch of other problems because there's a huge amount of environmental destruction and resource depletion that is going to go into the production of electric vehicles, in particular electric vehicle batteries. Which are not really recyclable with any known technology at the moment, at least not in any easy way. You have to do them by hand and cell by cell. This is going to create a huge raft of problems in capitalism. Why is it going to create problems in capitalism? Basically because the market says each individual has to have an electric vehicle. You know, who wants one? It's sell to the individual, and never mind the consequences. And of course, yeah, it's just nonsense that we would do that in socialism. You know, yeah, it's not like we've never heard of buses. So, you know, for all these reasons, abundance in socialism doesn't mean an absolute plethora of stuff. It means smart use of less stuff and getting more work out of it. And we'll all be richer for using less stuff. Anyway, that's me. And the next person in is Andrew. So off you go, Andrew.
Paddy, we've always been good friends, haven't we? You know, but I couldn't agree with you less. I think that the point is it's the social relation of the personal attachment to those items that is the point. I mean, we have been in certain situations in the past where I've had to borrow your trousers, you know, but I wouldn't normally want to wear Paddy Shannon's trousers, you know, so I prefer Andrew Davis's trousers. So
I don't remember that occasion.
I think it was something to do with being in a yurt, which was quite a while ago, and you were doing your let's not go into that.
I think I've mercifully forgotten.
We'll sort of discuss that outside of the meeting. But the point is, I don't think that we ought to be giving an impression that people should have less within socialism. People should have more. That should be the point. You know, people should have nice things within socialism, not you know, things they can barely afford to buy, you know, because it gives them some form of temporary, you know, comfort or whatever. And I include myself within that. So, you know, look, I just honestly think that we need to get away from this idea of limits. I noticed that Steve has got his hand up as well. And Steve will probably disagree with me profoundly on my approach to this, but I honestly think that picking up a little bit on what Howard was talking about as well, and my great sort of influence originally, you know, in the party was Ron Cook. This idea that if we get rid of all of the wasteful nature of capitalism, all those bits that don't matter, and also sort of understand that capitalism is essentially a way of rationing a world of abundance and expanding abundance, then let's go from there. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. And Steve, next. Steve, do you want to take back over the chair as you started it?
Well, I wasn't going to take issue with Andrew. I am now.
do you want to take the chair? Take back the chair while you're doing that.
If you want, I'll take it back. Well, I think we're coming to the end, aren't we? I'm picturing John looking out of his window at all these people with the lawnmowers, and thinking, why the hell are we restricting ourselves to the idea that we'll all live in these little atomized units with our patch of 4 square yards of bloody whatever, 4 square yards of couch grass, and instead of imagining some magnificent residences with magnificent public gardens and all that sort of thing, public provision. To me, that's the way that we've got to go. And when you talk about Andrew, I'm feeling really sorry for you. If you've got some sort of emotional attachment to a car or something like that, don't forget that these things are all being sold to you with one thing, well, on the basis of, for example, your personal freedom. And then remembering when I used to commute to Manchester, and this must have been the same for John when he was driving to work, of all these individuals sitting in the bloody cars expressing an individuality and basically going off the frigging heads. I think we've got to break. I think in a socialist society, there'll certainly be a break between personal, between this idea about ownership and objects. I don't want your trousers, by the way. But other things, I'd be more than happy to share with you. I just wanted the real reason I put my hand up was because I wanted to bring your attention to the fact that Roger Hallam has just brought out, he must be in the nick, according to this, because he's created a series of podcasts created called Designing the Revolution, which is now on YouTube. So that might be worthwhile having a look at. He wants to design the revolution. Bless him. So let's see what he's up to now. All right, that's me. Oh, hang on. No, I'm chair again, aren't I? sorry. Does anybody want to raise any new issues? Any other issue? Or shall I ask Adam to do a wonderful summing up? Speak now or forever hold thy peace, brothers and sisters and comrades. Right, go ahead, Adam, if you want to make a summary.
No, I think on this question of waste, I think Howard made a relevant point. It isn't just the waste of individual lawnmowers and power tools and so on. It's the whole waste of capitalism. I think estimates have been made that about half the production of capitalism isn't needed because it's to do with buying and selling or commerce and all that. And the other one, which Howard mentioned, the military. So there's a huge waste of resources, within capitalism. So we could probably meet our needs at least eventually with less production, which would mean less energy and less use of materials or more recycling materials. I think we should concentrate when we criticize capitalism on that waste, not the waste that individual. Individual workers think some people haven't got a choice about whether they have a car or not. And some people live in neighborhoods where they do have, shared lawnmowers and shared power tools and so on. But I think the main criticism should be directed at the waste of the whole capitalist system, which, as I say, it's a system of buying and selling, commerce, and the military. But to come back to the you know, main, or at least not main, but the starting point, I think that there is a parallel that, you know, Pat made between CND and the Extinction Rebellion. You know, both of them are starting from the premise that these problems are so urgent and so important that is what we should concentrate on. We should not necessarily neglect socialism, but put it on the back burner and deal with these problems. But of course, this is begging the question. It's assuming that these problems can be solved within the capitalist system. But as they can't, I mean, you know, their argument doesn't. It doesn't stand, and they end up, in fact, prolonging the capitalist system, and so prolonging the problem. So what we need to do is to emphasise the urgency of advocating socialism, not climate justice or nuclear disarmament. Anyway, this discussion seems to have gone on for, well, 2 hours, which is unusual, I think. But unfortunately, there is no meeting next week. It would normally have been a meeting for our friends in the East, but nobody came to the last one, so those meetings have come to an end. So the next meeting is going to be in a fortnight's time, which is going to be a discussion on the current strike waves called Enough is Enough is Not Enough. Back to you, Chair.
Okay, all right. Okay, okay. Thanks, Adam. That sounds good. It's going to make a great leaflet title as well, by the way. Enough is Enough is Not Enough. I think we should go for a leaflet for that. Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your attendance, comrades, and for your patience, if you've got any, and your contributions. Okay. Wish you all good night and safe night.